Hey, everybody. Just a warning. This episode includes strong language and explicit descriptions of drug use. Keep little ears out of the room.
It's time to play the game. Time to play the game!
I actually met him in 1981. The night before the royal wedding with Prince Charles and Lady Diana, I was basically walking past his club late at night, just wandering the streets looking for something to do, and saw Lemmy in the foyer and went in without paying and asked for an autograph, you know, kind of drunk and stuff. And he was like, "Have you got a pen?" I'm like, "Oh, no, of course I haven't got a pen." And he gave me his drink and like, "Oh, this, drink this, and I'll go and get a pen." And I just didn't think he was coming back, because why would you? You know what I mean?
Have you ever had one of these moments? I once saw Jemaine Clement at Newark Airport, and I freaked out. I had my baby strapped to my chest, I'm exhausted, I have all this luggage at my feet, and I wanted to risk losing my luggage to TSA and run after Jemaine Clement and let him know I love Flight of the Conchords. But I realized I couldn't run after him in flip-flops with a baby strapped to me. And I couldn't leave my 7-month-old son on the luggage carousel. So I understand music journalist Morat's impulse, and I give that 17-year-old punk a lot of credit. In the words of Lemmy, logic should not interfere with determination. And for Morat, you could gain a friend for life.
That night, he was with a couple of Hell's Angels and obviously a girl on each arm and stuff. And I was very intimidated. But the fact that, you know, he gave me a drink, gave me a cigarette, went off and found a pen, like must have searched the club for a Sharpie and came back and signed my shirt and stuff.
He has been described as an LA rocker, a radioactive cowboy, a world-class biker, Captain Hook, Black Bart meets Mad Max, God. His name should be a verb. He is Lemmy. Welcome to A Life Lived. I'm Stephanie Okupiak. Ian Fraser Lemmy Kilminster was born December 24th, 1945, in Stoke-on-Trent in Staffordshire, England. Shortly after he was born, his father left, and he and his mother moved in with his grandmother in Newcastle. Writer Stefan Shirazi was best friends with Lemmy, and he told me this is where his appreciation for women stemmed from.
He really loved women, not just in the rock and roll way, but he loved and appreciated, you know, females, female energy. I mean, he was raised by women. And I think it had a profound effect on him. You know, I think he was a very kind and gentle person within the exterior, but he also, the interior rather, but he also had a fierce, fierce drive to do what he wanted to do.
He had the sand, the sea, and the horses. He described his childhood as happy. When he was 10, his mother remarried and they relocated to Wales. Wales is beautiful, but it can be very isolating for a young English boy. He didn't speak Welsh and was picked on for being English. He actually got the nickname Lemmy from school, but to be honest, Lemmy himself couldn't remember how he got his name. One day, a boy brought a guitar to school and was immediately surrounded by girls. Lemmy was so fascinated by this phenomenon that the next day he brought his mother's guitar in and saw the same effect happen to him.
I think it was just natural. It's not something you choose. It chooses you, I think. Like, to a certain extent, you don't have a great deal of choice about it. I was the same when I was a kid. I was like, you get picked on a lot, as he was when he was young, because there's something people can smell odd about you, you know, normal people, if that makes sense.
This was before rock and roll existed. The records he grew up with were Rosemary Clooney and church hymns. When Elvis came out, his life changed, and he knew what he needed to do. He couldn't consume enough rock music. He obsessed over the sounds of Buddy Holly and Little Richard. He saw the Beatles in Liverpool before they hit the big time. He always felt they were the best band in the world, claiming they were more hardcore than the Stones because they came from the streets of Liverpool, whereas the Stones came from the burbs of London. After school, he moved to Stockport and worked a multitude of odd jobs, including house painting, horse breeding, and working in a factory. Well, until his hair grew out and they fired him. At night, he played with the Rainmakers and then the Motown Sect in clubs across the North. In 1965, he joined the Rockin' Vickers, and they signed with CBS Records. They toured with The Who and The Kinks around Europe. This is where Lemmy started playing with his hardcore sound and found his signature feedback note. They had three singles and lived together in a shared flat in Manchester. In 1967, Lemmy packed up his guitar and moved to London to swim in the counterculture movement. He shared a flat with Noel Redding, who was the bassist for the Jimi Hendrix Experience, and their road manager, Neville Chesters. Lemmy's next odd job? A roadie for Jimi Hendrix, for a while. But it was clear he would rather play an instrument than carry it. He would hang out with the musicians until they let him play.
He certainly did allude to the fact that he learned an awful lot watching Hendrix, and that Hendrix's aura certainly touched him, in a very special way.
Basically, Hendrix was what stopped him playing guitar, because he realized he was never going to be that awesome. And he was a natural bass player anyway. He was born when the war ended, and there was this euphoric atmosphere, you know, and then he grew up to see the birth of rock and roll. He was just the right age for everything. He was the right age for punk rock, right age for the hippie thing. And he got to experience all of it firsthand.
Lemmy fell desperately in love with a young girl named Susan Bennett. During their relationship, she became addicted to heroin, and Lemmy found her one day dead in a bathtub from an overdose. She was Lemmy's first true love, but Lemmy would be the first to admit she was not perfect. Because of the tragic circumstances of her death, Lemmy would never go near heroin or opioids, and would advise anyone he knew to avoid them as well. But he was open-minded to how the drug and those addicted should be treated. When he was asked to speak to the Welsh Assembly in 2005, he recommended legalizing the drug so the government could regulate it. In 1971, Lemmy was absorbed into the space rock band Hawkwind. I say absorbed because he originally auditioned to be their guitarist and got in, but at the last minute they decided they didn't need another guitarist. However, they were playing a gig in Notting Hill that night, and their bass player never showed up, but he left his equipment behind. Lemmy had no experience on bass, but he didn't want the opportunity to pass him by.
In life, you have a love that got away, or maybe your first love was, you know, you'll always have a slight soft spot. You may not love that person anymore today, but you will always have a soft spot for that person. You know, the first person to really shake your tree or whatever. I think Hawkwind was very, 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 very much, very copacetic with him and really, really in tune with his values and who he was and what he wanted to do, you know, combined with a biker gang or something, you know, that kind of vibe. And I think that suited Lemmy to the ground. They were very progressive. I mean, they were very, very aggressive as well. You saw one thing, but they delivered another. I mean, Lem used to tell a story about the fact that whenever they played the Roundhouse, they would actually put acid in all the bar bottles. So anyone who was having a drink was also going to take a ride. This was not an innocent jam band. This was a psychedelic, aggressive, insanely deep collection of motherfucking music. It really was, you know, and it took you on some very, very, I thought, some very, very dark and mysterious rides and incredible journeys. And they could not have lasted in that incarnation. it's impossible. And they didn't.
Hawkwind was touring in Michigan and Canada when they decided to fire Lemmy for taking too many drugs.
The wrong type of drugs, I think. Yeah, he got caught at the border of Canada. I mean, and they were being a bit off with him anyway. They left him at a truck stop somewhere by accident because he went off to take some photos. And then he had to hitch all the way across the US to get to the gig. But yeah, he got caught with speed at the Canadian border. And they charged him with cocaine, which is why he got away with it, because they gave him the wrong charge. So he was in the cell for a couple of days and then they let him go. And they couldn't charge him again because they'd done a mistaken charge. He's actually in the law books as well, because he got caught with some like cannabis resin or something years ago in England. And it was such a small amount that you couldn't see it. So the judge, there was a new ruling that you had to be able to see what you were being arrested for.
I never asked Lem if, you know, after his sacking from Hawkwind, if that was the first time he experienced bitterness. But I suspect he did, maybe hurt more than bitterness. He was very hurt. He was very jarred, I think, that anyone could strand him the way they did and actually engage in such deep hypocrisy, which, I mean, I think whenever you've got a bunch of people who are into drugs, hypocrisy is never too far away. That's the nature of that relationship, right? So that being said, it may have been the final stage of him fully maturing into the man that he became. You know, this is the hardest of knocks for him. He was very upset. I think Motorhead was formed for him as much as a protest. I mean, he initially wanted to call the band Bastard and was subtly advised, I believe, by Doug Smith, who's his manager at the time, that this might not be the best step forward if he actually wanted to get booked anywhere.
Lemmy wrote his songs on yellow legal pad and strummed the beats on his Rickenbacker bass. He wrote about everything from his disdain for government rule, the evil of child abuse, the mindlessness of war, and his hatred for authority. But he also wrote about his love for debauchery, and songs like Ace of Spades and I Got Mine became anthems for generations. The album Overkill was a reflection and an escape from 1979.
Thatcher was right around the corner. Britain was in the toilet. This was not a fun time to be in England, and it was not a positive time. You know, things felt pretty grim. And so Overkill as a record just came and fucking smashed that. It gave people such a loud and an exciting escape. And to see these three people led by this, you know, this guy who really, you know, he didn't give a fuck. He was going to do what needed to be done. And P.S., they were not, you know, they weren't coiffured. They weren't like, you know, wearing designer clothes, makeup. They were you and you were them, right? I think Motorhead as a band at that point were a touchstone for a young generation looking for something to believe in and to get behind, and something that represented their frustrations and what they wanted to express. And, you know, so it's interesting. Whilst not a political album in any way, I've always felt that it came as a consequence of an era to be a very important statement of the time. So yeah, absolutely. And then Bomber, what, 6 months after? 8 months after? Come on.
Lemmy was clever and witty and would happily share his views to whomever would listen. He attracted the misfits, respected people, and took the younger generation seriously.
There was a warmth and goodness about him that, you know, if you're a good person, you were welcome. You know, come spend time, come enjoy my band, come and be part of what we're doing. Just the only thing, don't be an asshole. I don't care if you're a punk, a rocker, mod, whatever. If you're a good person and you enjoy us and you enjoy the lifestyle and the community, you're in, you know, and that was kind of how he lived his life.
Speed ran in Lemmy's veins. Smoke filled his lungs, and he would drink the youngest fan under the table. Even with all of these substances, he never acted incapacitated or gave a sloppy performance.
We actually did a feature for Kerrang! Years ago where that was my brief, was to keep up with him. I think that was like 1999 or something. And he drank me under the table to the point where I interviewed him three times because I couldn't remember doing the first two. And he was very patient about it, actually, because by the third time I was getting annoyed, you know, asking the same questions and not remembering any of the answers. But, he was just indestructible. And I remember going to see him not long before he died. And I said, I'm glad you've stopped doing the speed, you know, because that's just not good for you. And he's like, what do you mean stopped? I haven't stopped. I still do that. I'm like, why? And he went, well, because I like it. And it was simple as that. You know, it makes me happy, so I do it. And his speed was vicious. I did it with him a few times, and I realized that I couldn't do that either and wouldn't want to. Like, you're awake for 3 days from a tiny little amount, you know. I remember talking to him about not doing acid anymore because I was getting too many bad trips. And he was like, well, yeah, but that's your mind that's doing that. You can't blame the drug for that. You know, and I'm like, I don't want to sit and talk to the devil. And he was like, yeah, but the devil is you. It's coming from your head.
Even Motorhead would have to take a small break in between gigs. And we're going to do the same. But stick around if you want to find out how a rock-singing speed freak can pull thousands of women wearing cowboy boots and Daisy Duke shorts.
A Life Lived is sponsored this week by Free Trade, the commission-free stock trading and investment app. Now, we all know that investing is one of the best ways to grow wealth over the long term. But if you're anything like me, you'll have been put off by high commissions and clunky products from traditional stockbrokers and all that jargon that makes it complicated for, you know, regular people to start investing. Free Trade is on a mission to break down these barriers by opening up stock investing to everybody. So while other stockbrokers will charge up to £12 for every trade, Free Trade, as the name suggests, doesn't charge any commission fees, so you can invest and keep more of your profits. Free Trade's beautifully designed and award-winning app is used by over 250,000 people. It's authorized by the Financial Conduct Authority, and it's protected by the FSCS, so you can buy and sell stocks and other investments with confidence. Want another reason to feel secure? Free Trade has been the winner of the British Bank Awards 2 years in a row for Best Online Trading Platform. Sign up to Free Trade today by heading to fretrade.io/AlifeLived. And once you create your account, you'll get a randomly allocated free share for a company like Greggs, Rightmove, or even Apple, worth between £3 and £200. Now, of course, whenever you invest, your capital is at risk. The value of investments can go down as well as up, and you may receive back less than your original investment. For more information, visit freetrade.io. That's FRETRADE.IO. This episode contains strong language and explicit descriptions of drug use.
Motorhead's road crew was always the same, and that's how Lemmy liked it. It became his family. They loved each other. They hated each other. But no matter what, they kept coming back. Lemmy was a consummate perfectionist and wouldn't trust his gigs in the hands of anyone else. To make sure the venues they played were paying attention, Lemmy had a very specific request in his contract.
He had I think one of the things that is kind of brilliant, actually, is such a great thing, because it's such an idiosyncratic Lemmy thing to do. I mean, I've not seen anyone do this, but he had a Kinder Egg, was always on the rider, toward the latter years, you know, the chocolate Kinder Egg, but it has to be the one with the toy in it. And it was literally one of the first things he'd do whenever he got into the dressing room is he'd break the egg open and he'd put the toy together. And so, it was a fair point of excitement for him was to put that little Kinder Egg toy together. But I remember soon after he passed, went to the Harris Street apartment just to sit in it and just to sit and meditate or whatever you would do. But I do remember looking around, and I'd noticed this many times before, but it really hit me at that time was he had, tens of dozens of all the little Kinder Egg toys that he put together over the years on a shelf somewhere. I think it was a shelf or on top of a sideboard. But it was just such a brilliant indicator of him, because it's such a finite thing. I mean, you know, and it's also quite childish in its own way, but it's quite brilliant, you know. I think the Kinder Egg was a big deal. It was a big deal when I observed it anyway. But that dressing room was an oasis of calm, and he would sit there and he would read. He would read and read, and then he'd play the machine sometimes.
As long as you didn't interrupt his fruit machine, he was fine. You could get. I never saw him turn down an autograph or a picture or anything, but he'd carry on playing while he was doing so. Because he always lost more money than he won. Although he did have a couple of big wins. I think he told me he won 35 grand out in Vegas one time.
I just saw them everywhere. I think he enjoyed them. I think he always enjoyed gambling. I mean, it was a thing of relaxation for him. I mean, even in his later years, he'd take off to Vegas for a few days and go and play. We never really got into it with the fruit machines. I don't know where they first started. I couldn't tell you. You know, he always seemed to have one. But any sort of video machine, he loved fruit machines. He liked the quiz games as well. He liked those little quiz machines as well. I think it was a German promoter who had one specially made for him many years ago, and it would go on tour, and it was always in his dressing room. And, you know, his dressing room is a very controlled environment in a sense.
The volume that Motorhead played was at a decibel so high it would leave his audience stone deaf and begging for more. If you were the band following them, you better reset all of the equipment or you were about to get a brutal surprise.
He did say that, I mean, my ears ring as well, and he had the tinnitus thing, but he said it wasn't too bad. And he's like, funnily enough, when I snort, it goes away. I'm like, well, you do snort quite a lot.
Sid Vicious tried to learn to play bass from Lemmy, and Lemmy wrote him off.
He said, I remember Sid. He said, I see Sid in Notting Hill one day, and he looks at me and he says, Lemmy, I've joined the Sex Pistols. I'm the new bassist. And I said to him, but Sid, you can't fucking play bass. And he said, I know, it's great, isn't it? And he went dancing down the street, and I looked at him and I thought, fucking hell, how long is this going to last?
Lemmy would never refer to Motorhead as a heavy metal band. He always just saw themselves as a rock band. But the truth is, they created a genre of music no one had ever heard of before them. Even Ozzy Osbourne acknowledges Motorhead was the very first heavy metal band. They set the benchmark for Guns N' Roses, Metallica, Motley Crue, and the Rollins Band. They are their own genre. A cocktail of punk, metal, speed, and rock. You cannot compare Lemmy and Motorhead to anyone because there has never been and there will never be another. Lemmy was the original influencer. Lemmy is God. But Lemmy always saw God as a woman.
He always told me that she was much taller. But yeah, I mean, he was aware that he was an icon, but it didn't really... I don't think it was something that registered as like he had to live up to it or anything. And he was aware that he was a rock star. He was always like, you've got to be something out of this world if you're going to be a rock star. But he also said that you can be a rock star without being an arsehole, which he managed for his whole life, you know.
Metallica's drummer Lars was so obsessed with Motorhead as a teenager that he stalked Lemmy outside his hotel, befriended him, and became the groupie following their bus while they toured California. This young, eager kid was welcomed into their hotel at each stop and was greeted backstage the whole time. Morat did the same, but around cold, rainy England.
We were following the tour, me and my friend, on the bike, and we got up to Manchester and it was sold out and it was snowing and all this sort of. And I'm like, we'll just write him a letter and see what happens. And I gave it to one of the road crew, like, we're following the tour, it's sold out, it's freezing out here. And 5 minutes later, these two passes came out, which no other band would do either. They, you know, and the rest of the tour, he put us on the guest list, and that's how I got to know him, just following the tour. But I knew him for 35 years.
Motorhead relocated to LA, and Lemmy fit in like a duck to water.
He was so happy when he first moved to LA. I mean, he was he'd wanted to make that move all his life, I think. And when he finally did it and got there, the first few years in LA, he was beaming, you know?
You can't go wrong with a rent-controlled apartment within walking distance of the Rainbow Room. It became Lemmy's second home. Any time of day, you could find him playing the trivia machine at the end of the bar, smoking a cigarette, drinking a Jack and Coke, and reading his mail, which he had delivered to the Rainbow Room.
He first went to the Rainbow, I think, in 1973, he was telling me, with Hawkwind, and just fell in love with the place. And that's why he got his apartment sort of walking distance from there. And he was definitely the king of, like, I remember walking many times with him from his apartment to the Rainbow, and people would just be shouting his name all the way up the road, you know, Lemmy! And people would go there just to see if he was there. Even if he was on tour, people would go there and have a drink in his seat just so they could, you know, they could say they'd been there.
When you walked in the door of Lemmy's apartment, you would see his life and mind stacked from floor to ceiling. It was full of Motorhead memorabilia, fan art, a cachet of swords and blades, custom boots, hats and jackets, books about history, ashtrays full next to his PlayStation controller, and a glass of Jack and Coke. Few famous musicians spend their entire careers working solely for music and not caring about the money, but Lemmy did. A mansion with tennis courts, a pool, landscaping, a gate, and a million rooms was never a desire of Lemmy's.
I don't think he ever thought that was necessary, partly because he grew up in squats and all that, so as we all did, you know, and you didn't even know if you were going to have a home when you got home. You might have been evicted or whatever. But he was. I was talking to him about that one time for an interview, and he was just like, what do you need a mansion for? Half of them can't even find it. And then you get there and you've got this big place to knock around in on your own, or, you know. But yeah, he didn't need any of that. He was on the road most of his life anyway. So you don't need a big place. And he was just comfortable with what he had.
Now that Lemmy had left behind the gray clouds of Britain, he could embrace the West Coast lifestyle his way. He would never retire his custom-made boots and Confederate general hats. But he loved feeling the breeze up his Daisy Duke shorty short shorts.
One time on a bus in the 80s, I remember we were on a bus for, I think we did 2 weeks with one hotel with 14 people, 15 people on a bus. I mean, that's you know, you're sharing at gigs and so on and so forth. So, but that's quite a petri dish of life right there. You know, there's no room for the week in that setup. And I think I saw Lemmy in his underwear, you know, multiple occasions. And I think the thing that like stunned me the most was just how utterly pale his legs were. I remember looking and thinking, fuck me, these legs have not seen the sun possibly since he was an infant, and, you know, being walked by as well. They looked so sun deprived, it was amusing. Yeah. And so then you flash forward to when he did move to LA, and then you'd go to the Harrod Street apartment, and, you know, he'd be like, yeah, I'll be on the roof. You know, you'd go up. Well, first of all, he's sunbathing. I mean, you know, he's sunbathing at 11 in the morning, having not gone to bed the previous evening, of course. Yeah. And then he had a tan. You're like, well, what happened here? You know, and then, as you say, he started wearing these outrageous shorts. And I mean, anybody else, you just look, you'd be like, hey, you look like a total wanker. But he sort of made it work. I think it was a combination of the shock of seeing Lemmy with a tan, plus this complete and utter just huge confidence in being able to wear this stuff and not give a fuck. He didn't give a fuck.
The first time Dave Grohl met Lemmy, he was leaving the club Crazy Girls, and he saw Lemmy in the corner. He was starstruck and had to introduce himself. He walked over and said, hi, I'm Dave Grohl. I have a band called the Foo Fighters, and I used to play drums in Nirvana. The first thing Lemmy said to him was, I'm really sorry about what happened to your friend. That's Lemmy. He was the genuine article. What you saw with Lemmy was exactly what you got. A gentle giant. To the best of his knowledge, he had 2 kids, but he only had a relationship with his son, Paul Inder. They met when Paul was 6 years old. Tracy, Paul's mother, frequented in rock and roll circles, It was after Paul began asking questions about his father that she decided to find Lemmy and introduce them. They kept a relationship after that. They played music together, PlayStation, and they partied together. Lemmy considered Paul to be his most priceless possession. And whether or not he realized it, Lemmy was a father figure to a lot of people, friends and fans.
I was, 19, 20 years old. I was a bit of a lunatic, getting in fights and all this sort of stuff and driving around drunk on my motorcycle. And he had words with me one night. I turned up at Dingwalls and he's like, I want to talk to you. And I'm like, oh, there, he's got his serious face on. And he got a whole bottle of Jack and we went and sat in the corner and he gave me like father talk. That I'd never really had a father figure in my life, you know. And he just sat and said, you know, you've got a brain in there, you should use it. And if you keep doing this, you're going to die. Simple as that. And because it's Lemmy, you listen, you know. Again, he was taking time out of, he was, you know, surrounded by girls and stuff. But he took, you know, we'd be there for a couple of hours. Just sat in the corner, me and him chatting. And other people don't take that time for people they care about, you know. And he had a good point because, you know, he was talking about the fighting. I was never winning. I used to go out and get in fights every night and most of the time I'd lose. But I think he'd seen a lot of people go on the wrong path. And it was funny because he was very proud when I started working at Kerrang because obviously I knew him before all that. And he's like, I told you you could do something. And then again, he was really oddly thankful sometimes. Like I gave the Sacrifice album 5 out of 5. Because it's still one of my favorite albums and I've got the logo tattooed on my hand, you know. And he was always thanking me for such a great review. And I'm like, you don't need to thank me. I owe you, you know, it's not the other way around.
Lemmy was a military history buff. He had a huge collection of World War II memorabilia, including an unsettling amount of Nazi artifacts. But it wasn't just Nazi artifacts. It was blades, swords, and banners from around the world. He described war as the best and worst of humanity. It shows you who your true friends are. He made it clear that his fascination was from the human ingenuity and morality standpoint, and he never shared Nazi views.
He knew what he was talking about. And again, a more inclusive, less prejudicial human being I have never met. I think he was almost alarmed when people did think that he might have prejudices and so on, because the only prejudice he ever had was against us he would call arseholes. He just didn't like arseholes. I mean, that was it. But everyone else, you know, he was in. And I do wish sometimes in reflection he'd been a little more defensive about, you know, his interests and so on and so forth. But that wouldn't have been in his DNA. He would have felt that was apologizing and he didn't feel he had anything to apologize for and he didn't. So onwards he went. But I mean, people need to know that, you know, this was an extremely smart man and always had a book in front of him, always reading.
Occasionally, he'd use his vast knowledge of history to woo the ladies.
One night on the bus, many, many years ago, to a bus, you know, you had band members literally snorting piles of drugs, punching the shit out of each other and rolling down the aisle like a dust ball, you know, in a desert. And then, like, you know, springing up, snorting more drugs. But Lemmy's ensconced in the back lounge with the door closed. And if you went close to the back door and strained an ear, what you would hear was him describing to his paramour for the night, exactly what happened on the Titanic and to the fact that he could name the people that were on the boat. I mean, you know, this was him. I mean, what a bizarre scene, right? You've got chaos everywhere and then you've got him, you know, delivering a history lesson in the back with probably the most beautiful girl, you know, by far on the bus and probably of the entire evening, you know. So this was him, you know. I'm not going to tarnish his legend of the education too much. I'm sure that they engaged in some fun times, but my point being that around the fun, he also was not averse to talking about, you know, smart things or, you know, academic things, if you will.
Lemmy has claimed he has slept with over 1,000 women, but this was when he was 63. He justified this using math, saying he only averaged about 30 a year. Lemmy had said women want security, which is why he never got married. He felt life as a rock and roller on the road and the life of a family man would never work. He said sex lasts half an hour, if it's good, and rock and roll lasts an hour and a half, at least. For him, it was a no-brainer. Lemmy never married, but he did date Cheryl Kloeman for 19 years. Lemmy was loved by so many. His 50th birthday party was at Whiskey A Go-Go, and the club was filled with friends from around the world and celebrities paying him homage. Metallica played a special gig for the occasion. They all dressed up in black wigs, skin-tight jeans, cowboy boots, and tall hats. For one night only, they became the Lemmys, and they tore the house down. Lemmy played with other bands, other musicians, and all different types of music. He was the bassist for the rockabilly supergroup Headcat. They were in the recording studio doing a collaboration, and eventually, over a couple of Jack and Cokes, they decided, why not record an album? But after decades of living fast, Lemmy's lifestyle caught up with him. He was diagnosed with hypertension and diabetes. He began to curb back his drug taking, but it didn't stop him from smoking and drinking to his heart's content.
I never really figured out whether it was a tolerance or just a character set, you know, but he never was never out of control. Not in those later years. I'm sure in his younger years he was, but not in those later years. You know, he needed a certain level of alcohol and speed to function at a certain point. And, you know, I mean, we used to joke about it. And now I somewhat regret that maybe it wasn't done. I don't think it was. But, you know, I mean, there was definitely some research to be done on that body because I just don't understand how – I don't understand. You know, it doesn't make any sense. He never showed any ill effects.
Lemmy had a defibrillator put in, and it really shook his confidence. His friend, the guitarist for Guns N' Roses, Slash, supported him and encouraged him to continue playing, not just to small clubs, but to huge crowds like Coachella.
He wasn't afraid of dying, I know that. But he did get stage fright, same as anyone else. Right up until the end, he still had, you know, a little bit of nerves before going on stage, but that's the only thing I can think of that bothered him. And even then, it didn't really bother him. It was just he wanted to get it right.
This was what he was born to do. He was born to play. That was where he escaped. You know, I've no doubt as his health was getting worse, he didn't feel great. But when he was up there playing, he was playing. And that's what he was there to do. And if he didn't want to go out and do it, he wouldn't have done it. But that was him. You know, you'll see the same with several musicians of his era. You know, some people are like, well, why are they still trying to play and tour? Well, it's because that's what they do. It's almost cruel to tell them they can't. You know, imagine turning around to Lem saying, well, you shouldn't go out there. You know, your legs might not be able to take it. That's like a massive slap in the head. I mean, the man's pride and personality and everything is in that, as on that stage and in that bass guitar. You know, you're going to take that away from him because you think you know better.
I got a call saying that he'd been diagnosed with cancer and that he wanted to see his friends before he died. And I booked a flight. I'd moved to Vegas by that point. I used to be neighbours with him for like 6 years, but I'd recently just moved to Vegas. So I booked a flight to go out and see him I got a call on a Monday, booked a flight to go and see him on Wednesday. And then by the time I put the phone down on the flight, they called me back and said he'd passed. And it was sad not to say goodbye to him, but at the same time, what are we going to do? We're going to sit there and, sorry, you're dying then, you know. So it was, I don't know, I got mixed feelings about that. It would have been nice to spend one more day with him, but I think it would have been quite a sad day.
Lemmy died on December 28th, 2015, just 3 days after his 70th birthday.
He went out exactly the way he wanted to. You know, you've got cancer, you've got maybe 6 months. And he's like, no, I'm going in 2 days, right after his birthday. And literally died in front of his favourite machine with his boots on and a drink in his hand. You know, that sort of sums Lemmy up.
The funeral was streamed live for anyone to watch.
People did turn up to his funeral. There was a packed house. There was I was going to say a difficult day, but it was just a nice way for him to go out. It was perfect, you know. I actually spoke at the funeral, which was a very scary thing to do because I'm not a public speaker. and not a rock star or anything. But they asked me, and I was like, oh, no, I can't do that. I don't speak in public. And they went, well, you kind of have to. He's your best friend. I'm like, yeah, all right. So I got a little bit drunk before that. I snuck a bottle of Jack Daniels in with me, but then I got there and they had crates of it. They were giving out shots as you came in, you know. They were like Ozzy and Slash and Josh Homme and Dave Grohl and all these huge rock stars and stuff. And I didn't really give a long speech because it, you know, I don't do speaking. Just had a little toast to him. But it, I mean, it was a nice way for him to go because he was the last thing they did before we all left was hit the bass, so it, you know, was feeding back like it did at the end of a Motorhead gig. And that was the signal for us all to leave, but no one wanted to go. We just stood there listening to that one more time, you know.
You could feel the bass shudder through your bones.
And then we all went to the Rainbow and got hammered.
Lemmy described his life as a rocker as controlled madness. He was proud of the legacy of Motorhead and that they had survived the bad reviews for decades.
I remember him quoting, I think it was Oscar Wilde, "What happens after you're dead?" And he says, well, a lot of things happen after you're dead. They just don't involve you. But, I mean, obviously he's going to live on with his music forever. That's the legacy he left behind, you know. I think people knew him even if they hadn't met him. Because that he was just, that's who he was, you know. And even if you've never said, even spoken to him, it was very much what you see is what you get. That's what it says on the packet and that's what you're getting, you know. And I think he was an inspiration for a lot of people to be a better person, you know.
After he passed away, the cocktail Jack and Coke was officially renamed the Lemmy. And a heavy metal element discovered around the same time he passed away was petitioned to be called Lemonium. He's original. A renegade. Respected and revered across generations and genres. Lemmy described the closing scene of the film depicting his life, showing him vanishing up the top of a mountain under a flash of lightning, leaving behind a plaque saying, "Fooled you, again." He left this world with no regrets. He won some, he lost some. It was all the same to him. He certainly never wanted to live forever. Forge ahead and take no prisoners. Morat is a music journalist, and you can read his work in Kerrang or on his website, morat.rocks. Stefan Shirazi is a writer and is the current editor of Metallica's magazine called So What. Next time on A Life Lived.
They were laughing, and she said, well, just come into the house, and I'll show you he lives here. So they got out of the car. The mother was kind of telling Rachel that she shouldn't be making up lies. They walk into the house and George is on the couch in the living room in his underwear, and they walk in like, you know, like one of those Hollywood buses, you know, that go by that are staring at all the people. And she came through the living room and she said, "See, there he is." And it was quite, George had said at dinner that night. Yeah, it was quite funny. It was like these people were walking by and just pointing at me. It was really kind of strange, but it's fun.
We've listened to his careless whispers on dates and watched him shake his hips in our dreams. But few people have had the pleasure of having George Michael lounging on their couch in his underwear. Join us next week when we find out how the pop icon of the 80s lived in a life of secrecy while becoming the sexiest man in the world. This is an Audio Boom original production by Muddy Knees Media and Breaking Stereotypes. This podcast was presented and executive produced by me, Stephanie Okupniak. Our series editor has been Lucy Oliva. If there is an icon that you would like to know more about, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram using the handle @alifelived_.